Exish number 10897, reel 4.
Commander Grice, reel 4.
Well, very shortly after that, I was over the coast, and a few minutes later, I was a mile out to sea, and a few minutes after that, I was 2 miles out to sea. And, before that, of course, I'd taken my helmet off and dropped it. And that gave rise to a moment of immense panic, because I actually watched my helmet drop from, I suppose, 12 or 13,000 feet until it disappeared from view. I suddenly realized how high I was and how much space there was between my toes and the ground. So I hung on to my straps like mad. Well, the sea gradually approached, and I wasn't a bit worried because I was coming down, going to splash down, only a couple of hundred yards from a little fishing trawler. Well, the splash happened, and I got rid of my harness, looked round, and there was the trawler, and I waved like mad. Oh, I had tried to blow up my Mae West. I wasn't terribly successful, because something seemed to have happened to my face. There were sort of bits of skin flapping around my eyes, and my mouth felt very uncomfortable. Of course, I'd been burned. So I waved at the trawler, got a wave back, and they went straight ahead. I thought, well, what sods these they are. But they'd seen something that I hadn't seen, which was a motor torpedo boat coming out from Harwich, 2 or 3 miles away, making straight for me. And it eventually arrived, and they hauled me on board. And I started to feel rather sorry for myself, I think. Anyway, we got back to Harwich, and I was put into an ambulance and taken to the Naval Hospital at Shotley. Put on a bed, and a nurse came along to cut me out of my uniform. I couldn't keep still. I was shaking like a leaf, very embarrassed. I said, I'm terribly sorry, I can't keep still. And the little young nurse smiled and said, well, don't worry, you're only suffering from shock, which I suppose was the case. And I was eventually seen by some naval doctor and wheeled into the operating theatre and eventually came to hearing a voice saying, it's all right, Mr. Grice, it's all right, Mr. Grice, it's all right, Mr. Grice. And this voice went on and on. Now, what had happened was that this splendid naval surgeon had cut away the bits of loose skin around my face, covered my face in something or other, and put a mask over it. So I had a mask from just underneath my hairline down to below my chin, and of course couldn't see anything, and they'd pierced a couple of holes for me to breathe through, and there was a hole, little hole, where my mouth was. And of course, what they were frightened about was that I would come to from this operation, realize I couldn't see, and start scratching at my face. And they'd put a little orderly by my bed to go on saying, it's all right, Mr. Grice, it's all right. But eventually, of course, I became fully conscious. I couldn't see anything. And this must have been late in the afternoon. Suddenly the air raid sirens went. And a nurse came to my bed and said, we've got to go downstairs. I was apparently on the first floor. So led by the arm, quite unable to see. I was taken downstairs, somewhere or other, by this splendid nurse, who was herself shaking like a leaf. Not surprisingly, because the bombs weren't all that far away. Anyway, a couple of days went by, and the surgeon came and said, I'm going to cut away a bit of the moss so you can see a bit more. And very, very gently scraped away at the mask until I could see quite a bit. And he scraped away a bit more around my mouth. And came the day when I got out of bed, had a look at myself in the mirror. Never had a bigger shock, because my mask had been covered in gentian violet. And there I was, absolutely purple, with this terrible looking mask and these holes in it. Talk about Frankenstein, it really was a sight. I was perfectly all right, I mean, feeling fine.
How much pain had you been in?
None at all. McIndoo told me later on, didn't mention McIndoo. I was taken by ambulance from shortly after a week to the Masonic Hospital in London, where Archibald McIndoo came to see me, still with a mask on. And I'd been burnt round my wrist too, and my ankles. And he looked at me and said, well, quite shortly I'm going to have to take a piece of your bottom. And he went on to explain, that's where I take skin when I have to do grafting. But he said, not yet. And I suppose it was, he came to see me again a week after that. And after a very good look, he said, you're one of these very lucky chaps. You're not going to need me. You're going to grow new skin. He said, the main reason is you came down in the sea. And we've learnt from you chaps that a brine bath is the best initial treatment for a bad burns case. And so it was to be. I mean, there was a time for a year or two afterwards when I had a red line around my face, the bit that wasn't covered by my mask where I'd been burned. And if I had a drink or two too many and got the old bloodstream working, this line would appear. But it's all grown away now, and when people learn that I was burnt during the war, they can't believe it. And I mean, I can see in my wrists, I've got various marks here where the skin didn't grow quite as well as it might have done. As far as my face is concerned, no one would ever know. And that, I'm sorry to say, was the end of my flying career. I never went back to operational flying.
What do you feel today in 1989 about having taken part in the Battle of Britain?
Well, it's nice to have played the part we all played at that time. I mean, we weren't conscious at the time that it was anything very special. After all, it was something we'd joined the Air Force to do. We'd been trained to do it. And we were earning our keep. And we did have morale-boosting talks by very senior officers. I remember one. Just before Dunkirk, or rather, just before we took part in Dunkirk, we'd flown up to Wittering to join other squadrons to take off the next morning to fly constant patrols over Dunkirk. And we were given a lecture by an Air Vice Marshal who made one or two very peculiar remarks. And the one I remember most of all, We were a mixture of Hurricane and Spitfire squadrons at this lecture. And he said, so far as you Hurricane squadrons are concerned, the only reason you've done so well in France is you haven't had the speed to run away. I mean, it was a deliberately provocative remark. I suppose to get us on our toes. Quite unnecessary.
To make you feel resentful, you think?
Yes, it did. For that reason, I mean, possibly we became a little more aggressive after that. Anyway, our morale was always extremely high. We were well led. With hindsight, of course, we could have done better. And as far as I was concerned, I didn't last long enough to put my experience to better use.
You were talking about this business of aggression, because some people say that some of the Central Europeans, like the Poles and Czechs, fought more aggressively than we did, at least at the beginning of the war. Did you ever feel that yourself?
Very much so, yes. I mean, we, because of our peacetime training, thought of number one attack, number two attack, number three attack. And, I mean, up to a point, it was quite sensible, because you were never going to shoot another aircraft down from the front, unless you're jolly lucky. I mean, with closing speeds of at least 500 miles an hour, there's only going to be a split second when you're going to be able to fire with any hope of hitting the enemy. Whereas if you're firing from astern, well, you've got not quite a stationary target, but one that's going to remain in your sights within firing range for several seconds. And if you're firing straight, you ought to be able to hit the enemy and do your stuff. But a Polish fighter pilot, in my experience, was quite prepared to ram the enemy. Didn't matter where it was. He had to be charged, would be the word. And I think it was the Poles who first realized that when attacking a bomber formation, if you were in front, the best thing to do was to go straight for them. Because if you went absolutely straight for them, you needn't fire. But the mere thought that here was an aircraft coming towards them on a collision course was bound to break the formation up. And of course, you could climb and dive down again. That was their idea, and of course it worked like a charm. But we, by this time, I mean the Battle of Britain, real Battle of Britain, had hardly started. It didn't really start with bombing raids on the mainland until, 12th of August. I think we met the first one. So I only lost it 3 days.
Coming back to this question of the sense of the importance of the Battle of Britain, did you have any feeling at all that an invasion might take place if the air war wasn't won?
We were very conscious of the threat of invasion. I mean, Biggin Hill, being not very far from the south coast, was made the subject of an invasion alert. Now, what that meant on the ground, I'm not absolutely certain, except for one thing. One always had to remove the rotor arm from the engine of one's motor car. I mean, in those days, those of us with motor cars would take them to the dispersal point on the airfield and hopefully come back to the same dispersal point, pick them up to go back to the mess after a flight. So a dispersal point was usually surrounded by pilots' motor cars. and we all had to take the rotor arm out. But apart from that, I don't know what happened on the ground. My wife might know better, because she was the code and cipher officer at Biggin Hill.
Did you mix much with the civilian population at this time in July, August 1940, or did you just not have any time?
It was a funny life to some extent, because Biggin Hill had adopted a pub at Braisted near Westrum called the White Hart. This is going back many years before the war. And more often than not, in peacetime, I'm talking of 1938-39, having come off duty at 4:30 in the afternoon and had a meal in the mess in the early evening, some of us would go down to the White Hart of Braisted for an evening's beer and darts. And this little custom went on right up until August the 15th, 1940. So a typical day, as far as I was concerned, in, let's say, July 1940, would be to fly a convoy patrol in the morning, take off with the squadron to escort a Blenheim raid on France in the afternoon, land back at Biggin Hill at 6:30, have a glass of beer, have a meal, and then down to the White Hart for beer and darts. Really was the most extraordinary life, because for part of the day you were in a state of some slight nervous tension, perhaps, and even had a battle, were rather exhilarated. And then for 2 or 3 hours in the evening, you were back to civilian life, playing darts with the local chimney sweep or the local dentist, and getting to bed about midnight, I suppose, up again at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Were the local civilians appreciative of what you were doing?
I don't think the war was ever discussed. I can't remember ever doing other than talking about girlfriends and playing darts.
They sound rather complacent then.
No, I think their thinking was that we didn't want to talk about the war. And we didn't. I mean, that day's war was over by the time we got to the pub. Mm-hmm. I mean, there would be 3 or 4 or 5 members of my squadron. We used to take the WAF officers down with us. There'd never been very many locals there. I think they'd come to know that it was our pub. It was run by a very interesting couple, Teddy and Kath Preston. And Preston was the son of the famous boxing impresario of the 1920s. It was Harry Preston, I think, who was a big noise in the boxing world. And I suppose the pub had been acquired by Harry Preston and taken on by Teddy, his son, in the days when I knew it. But they were very hospitable. I mean, at closing time, 10:30, no one ever thought of leaving. We just went to their lounge on the first floor at the back of the pub, where we went on drinking, perfectly legally, because we were in their home at that time.
Would you drink before you went up into combat?
No. Well, no, but that didn't stop us having several pints of beer in the evening, which hopefully had mostly disappeared by 4 o'clock the next morning.
How much of a strain was it all?
much of a strain. I don't think it... The only bad time was when you were trying to get some sleep. Because then inevitably you rehearsed what had happened during the day. You may have been fired at. So you knew that you'd been lucky that day. And were you going to be lucky as lucky the day after? And you know, one had one or two black thoughts. And that's really why, I suppose, one was very keen to have as much beer as you could consume, because it was an aid to getting to sleep. But once daylight came, absolutely no tension at all. A great surge of adrenaline, of course, when you saw the enemy. And that was natural, wasn't it?
What kind of casualties was your squadron suffering?
We were one of the lucky squadrons, in the sense that we lost very few killed. There was a time before 32 Squadron was withdrawn, which was towards the end of August. There were 11 of us, I think, in various hospitals in southern England, wounded in some way, injured in some way or another. But our sister squadron, 79 Squadron, on the other hand, suffered a lot of casualties.
Did you get very inexperienced pilots being thrown into the Battle of Britain without proper training?
Yes. The one I remember in particular was a Fleet Air Arm pilot. And this was late on, early August. I think he only survived one flight. He came to us when he'd only done probably 10 hours on Hurricanes. It must have been hell for them. At least I was. I'd flown a Hurricane for 18 months before the real war started in May 1940. So I was more at home in a Hurricane than anywhere else. Supremely confident.
Was there anything that could be done for the green pilots?
No, I mean, they had to be given one flight in a section or a squadron, manoeuvred round the sky. when I can remember taking up two very inexperienced pilots once, and I did all the... I told them to follow me, and I did all the most violent manoeuvres I could think of. And, of course, they couldn't keep up. I mean, one of their problems was how to control the aircraft. But there was no other way. They simply had to be got into the air.